All right, everybody, welcome into another episode of Debate Night. We've got an exciting panel today. We've got a new analyst today, and then we've also got a bunch of topics. This is our first post-event show, so we really have a lot of topical things to go over. So I think it's really going to be great. Go ahead and get into our analysts for today. We've got, as always, Brody Smith in the house.
There's one question I cannot wait to hear Hunter just absolutely botch.
Oh, yeah.
we've got Hunter as well.
Trevor, I just wanted to say, huge fan of the show. You look great today.
thank you. Point to Hunter. Or that's Jonah. Point to Hunter. We've got a brand new analyst today, Jonah.
What's up, guys? Excited to be here today. I've always wanted to throw down some snack talk with the Foundation boys, so now's my chance to do that.
Heck yeah. And then we're joined as well by Steven.
I'm at a clear disadvantage today. I'm up at 6 a.m. on the West Coast, so we're going to give them hell. Yeah.
Early bird gets the worm, though, so we'll just have to see what happens. We're going to start by jumping right into Las Vegas Challenge, first event of the year. It went about as you would expect the Vegas event to go, but there's certainly always a lot to look at when you have that first event of the year and who is standing out. So the first question I've just got here is, who surprised you the most in Vegas, and why is that? Brody, you can start off for us.
I'm going to go with Zach Arlinghouse. So a couple details from his tournament. He finished seventh place. He was five off the lead. His best finish last year was at D-Glow by quite a margin. 27th at D-Glow was his best finish. I don't think he maybe even eclipsed the top 50 at any other Disc Golf Pro Tour events last year. And he moved up 42 spots on U-Disc to a number 78 world ranking. So I got the pleasure of actually getting to play with him. Those listening might know Zach Arlinghouse from that like crazy kid we saw a couple years ago at Idlewild, where he was throwing like lefty rollers, righty rollers all over the woods. His game has come, I mean, it was pretty sharp. He was very solid putting inside of 45 feet. His backhand control looked incredible. He really does seem to kind of be building out. He's still just a kid. I don't believe he's more than 20 years old. He's someone that I think people should start putting him on the radar. He's got the talent and the skills. It's just going to be whether or not he puts in the time and effort to kind of make sure that this wasn't just a one-off and it's more of a consistent pattern or growth through his career on the Disc Golf Pro Tour.
Yeah, I like that. I didn't realize that he only had like that one decent finish last year. I thought his name was making more of an impression last year, but I guess not. And that's certainly one to watch. Hunter, who surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, Zach Arlinghouse was a great choice. He actually, when he was like 13, smacked up on me in my first MPO tournament. So shout out to him. Well, interesting point about him before I get into the first surprise me, he's actually more of a woods player. So he was a very surprising performance, I think, because like he normally does so well in the woods, but out in the open, he was able to pop off. So Brody had a great pick there. But honestly, I'm going to go with Kevin Jones, mainly because I think Kevin Jones, this is what we always expect of him. This is what we always hope for him. And then we're always disappointed. What I saw out of him this weekend was a very under control player, a player who performed under pressure. Now, questionable decisions late. We'll get into that later. I'm assuming that's what Brody thinks he's going to disagree with me about. But throughout the entire weekend, there was a lot of people at his heels. As he got closer and closer to that finish, he stuck to his game plan. He played well. He hit a lot of clutch putts when he needed to. And this tournament was closer than the scoreboard says at the end. So Kevin Jones, I was very pleased with, but also surprised that down the stretch, he was able to be as composed as he was and hit some of the shots he did.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to Jonah. Who surprised you?
So I'm going to take it to the FPO side and say Evelina Solonen. Now, yes, it's not surprising that her putting was that bad, but it is surprising that she did not make the cut. She was on caddy duty for Hannah Longridge in the final round. And I think Zoe Andheck said something along the lines of like, yeah, this is great camaraderie for the division. You know, the ladies got to sit together out there. Like, no, you're competitors, regardless of how good friends you are off the course. Like, that's not a good look for any competitive athlete. And yeah, it's a common argument to say, like, those with talent but don't work hard are going to fall to those without as much talent and work harder than them. You know, like, people like Missy Gannon, Owen Scoggins, who can't throw nearly as far as Evelina or Hannah or Paige or Kristen, you know, outperform Evelina week in and week out. So I think that, you know, Evelina's really got to rethink her putting game right now. And maybe Robbie C should give her some lessons.
Yeah, you're right about that. That's a good pick, Jonah. Steven, what do you got?
I really do like the Evelina pick. It was pretty shocking for her not to make the cut. I'm going to have to go with your boy, Ezra Aderholt, taking down second place, 29 down on the weekend. He's tied for two, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Brody's shaking his head at me, so I'm a little confused as to why. But he's taking down second place. He's normally a little sporadic. Biggest thing that shocked me about him this weekend, he only threw OB twice. That is a huge accomplishment on a big bomber course, really windy, lots of OB, lots of hazard. He only had two OBs on the weekend. Little Jekyll and Hyde on the putting green. It was kind of surprising. He threw 90% C1X on the Innova course, but only 43 on Millennium. Not sure why, but 90% on the Innova course, rounds two and four, final round, hot putting day. I will say honorable mentions, Eagle struggling with the forehand, or without the forehand, I should say. It's surprising because it's going to be a big storyline all season. I want to give a shout out to also Emmer Daddy taking down a top 10 on his first event of the season, and Kyle Klein, love it, starting off hot with fourth place. So
yeah, I think the Emmer Daddy, as you mentioned, might have snuck under the radar a little bit there. He put together quietly a really good tournament, especially playing with new discs. Brody, you didn't seem very surprised by
Ezra got second at Vegas 2 years ago. He plays really well at Vegas. It's a course that suits his game really well. I'm not surprised at, I mean, I think every year Ezra has a chance to win this tournament. So I'd be more surprised if he would have missed the cut than him finishing in the top five.
I mean, two shots OB though is two shots OB. That's a pretty insane statistic considering how that course is playing.
Next closest in the top 10 through seven times. He smoked the field in OB.
Wow. Yeah, that is pretty significant. I guess it's pretty clear to Ezra where his work needs to be done, and that seems like it's on the putting green. All right. Well, yeah, certainly there was a lot to pick from in Vegas. I think we had a good variety there. You know, first event of the season, you're always going to see somebody who is either way rustier than they should be or has surprisingly seemingly shook it all off already. Little points update heading into the next topic. Brody and Hunter at three, Jonah and Steven sitting at 4 points. And let's move on to a kind of a hot topic of the weekend, a little bit not really related to the play necessarily, but more so to the event. So much so, this was a case that Drew Gibson even made a hoodie about it. I feel like that's like what makes things noteworthy now, is if Drew Gibson makes a hoodie about it. So we had the interference situation going on with the golf cart getting hit by Cat. We have the rangefinder person getting hit by AB. And this is something that we've seen a few times on the Pro Tour, and it was just really notable in this event. That goose that just got in the way of Paul's drive, you know, can't believe that as well. So my question is this interference of spectators and volunteers becoming a serious issue that needs addressed? And if so, what is a good solution for that? Hunter, what do you think?
I think spectators is not an issue that needs to be addressed at all. I mean, spectators on the majority of the time, especially on this course, we're standing OB. And if you throw a shot OB and it happens to hit someone's ankle and you throw into the audience, you can see standing there the entire time, tough luck. You know, those are the breaks that happen out there. Now, volunteers are a whole different thing because that's a much more controllable element. In my opinion, I think that's something that should be addressed, especially on a course like this. Volunteers, or like the rangefinder guy, the rangefinder gate, he could have been pushed back as well as the cameraman well back. I don't think it's, like right now in disc golf, it's kind of a funny thing of like, oh, our cameramen are so good at dodging discs. That's not something to be proud of because that means they're in the way. They shouldn't be very good at dodging discs. That shouldn't be something you have to like put on your resume when you're applying. In my opinion, I think that camera crews, media teams, those volunteers, they should be like right in front of the spectator line when at all possible. There's some courses that's not possible because then it looks better for optics. You don't have random people standing in the middle of the fairway. And also it's a lot less likely that what happened to AB is going to happen to anyone else.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Jonah, what do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, Hunter hit it right on the head. Definitely needs to be addressed. I have a personal issue with people getting in the way of tournaments because I lost the tournament that way. So that's another topic for another day. But yeah, I mean, we all know that like Umbrella Gate from last year at GMC, that was a big deal. Any spectator who's within, you know, 2 meters of an OB line really shouldn't be there. And then we're kind of already starting to see this with like the retention sponsor walls that they're putting in your greens and stuff like that. I think that should be a rule the PGA puts into place, is like, hey, if you're a spectator, we love having you here, but you cannot be that close to the fairways. It's like, that's not a good look. But then again, like if a player intends to like play for a skip back into the inbounds, especially on like hole three at the end of a course, for example, like they should let the spectators know about that kind of stuff. And if they don't, that's an oversight on their end. And I mean, granted, and Hunter said this too, I think, but if a player just has an errant shot, they have an errant shot. It's part of the game. You can't control, you know, someone throwing into the crowd, like that guy on the tee of one at European Open, like hitting the car. Come on now. Yeah. Like that's a little bit overboard, but yeah, I mean, definitely needs to be addressed.
Yeah. All right. Steven, do you think it's an issue?
I don't think it's as big of an issue as it's being made out to be. You know, we hear about it a couple times a year. This tournament was a little strange because we had quite a few instances in the same tournament. I will say that the catch cam on the drives, you know, being out in the fairway, part of disc golf is the camera pan is part of the course. And if he's in the same position for all four drives, if you hit him, you hit him. He's part of the course. You see him there. You know he's there. That's my opinion on that. Distance checkers, volunteers, spectators, I do agree. They all need to be clear of the fairway. I think that this happens when the Pro Tour becomes more involved in the running of every tournament, and there are standards set for these things. You have to have a standard for how far your spectators should be from the OB lines. You have to also give the lead card a little more time between them and the chase card to allow the movement of crowds, the movement of volunteers, so you're not kind of bunched up on that lead card, causing a little more chaos like we saw with Katrina Allen and the rogue golf cart there. But again, she threw OB on that, so it's kind of on her as well. But I do think it does need to be addressed, but it's not as serious of an issue as everyone's kind of making it out to be because of this one tournament.
Yeah, I can see how it definitely could be. There can be overreactions sometimes with things like this happen, but sometimes you have to find those little problems and point them out. Brody, what do you think? Cameraman part of the course?
No, absolutely not. There's a zoom function on cameras, so we should probably be utilizing that zoom function. A couple things to unpack here. First one is this, I think, is not a serious issue right now, but it can become one very quickly if disc golf continues to have more and more spectators out. I mean, you have to realize that we're dealing with a very small amount of spectators currently, and also dealing with a very small amount of media. If disc golf continues to grow, that number is only going to increase. And so I think now's the time to start looking at some of the things to get better at, then when it becomes a serious issue. On the spectator side of things, something that we haven't really mentioned is pace of play. There was numerous times, and I was never near the top of the leaderboard, you know, so I had very small groups of spectators following some of our early round cards, but there were numerous times where players on my card would not throw because spectators were in the either line of sight or in the actual path of where we're trying to throw. So the actual walking and how spectators need to go from hole to hole needs to be, I think, worked out a little bit better or pushed off a little bit more, so that way there isn't this guy's clearly just walking from one hole to the other and has no idea that people are throwing. And so now we're staying there waiting because his back is turned and the person I'm playing with doesn't want to throw and potentially have him hit it. The Katrina Allen shot with the golf cart, that hole plays really well with her angle for a backhand into that hillside. I will say she probably did throw 30 or 40 feet right of where her aiming point was. But disc golf, you have to remember, it's not a straight shot a lot of times. And so having the disc curve from left to right or right to left is a natural thing. We shouldn't be having golf carts in positions right next to the basket. And then the camera thing down the fairway or even behind the basket, no one mentioned this. The behind the basket on putts that have prevented rollaways, prevented discs that have sailed by because it just hits the camera guy, that should just never happen. Mm-hmm. We should always be put in a position where we can zoom, we can pan, and never be in a spot to where a disc could potentially hit us.
I do think that it's interesting because Vegas is a course that I think just incites these issues because you have so many shots that are skipping or cut rolling within the out of bounds lines or like overlapping them essentially. Like you see it, I swear you see it almost every fifth shot. Somebody is skipping back from in from out of bounds or they're skipping towards the out of bounds. It just seems to happen a lot on that course because you're dealing with the wind, the really skip favorable grass. And also the rollaway situation with all the mounds. So I think this course just basically paints what could be the norm if some of the strategy isn't put in place. And I think the biggest thing, like you guys mentioned a lot, is just camera positioning and just working on. And I've done catch cam before, and it's not easy. It's not easy finding, like, especially if you don't know the course. I think that might be part of the issue is like maybe these camera guys just don't, especially that first round, maybe they don't know the course well enough to know where to stand. But that's a difficult thing to figure out. But I think the Pro Tour will know that they need to work on it.
None of these holes are long enough. That's the thing you got to remember, too. Most of these holes are like 700 feet, right?
Yeah.
That's not even a 300-yard drive. So, like, these holes are way shorter than what golf is having to deal with when it comes to their cameras. So, like, why aren't they just by the basket and zooming in and zooming out?
Well, depends on how nice the cameras are.
A potential solution to that is just for the tournament directors to be like, okay, you know, if on a par four, if the card in front of you is clear this position, then, you know, if it's a chase card and a lead card, then you have to wait, you know, until like this position and like make that really delineated so that there's not like a guessing game for like pace of play, Brody, and like so that they can, you know, have the pace.
Steve, what were you going to mention?
So I think Johnny V has actually talked about this with the cameras and their positioning. Part of the reason that they are so close is simply because camera quality, when you get out to a golf course, like for the PGA, those cameras are, you know, $250,000 a camera. The cameras that they have do not have the quality to go stand behind the basket and zoom all the way to the drive and then zoom out and pan and watch the disc from there. They don't have that quality yet. And until they do, it's unfortunate. But
that'll definitely be part of it. And I think too, because like right now, because we don't have enough cameras, sometimes you see drives land in places, like it already happens a lot where you see a drive land and you can't quite get eyes on the disc, and the further away you get from where the drive is landing, the less chance you have of that as well. So I think the camera, it's one of those things where it's just a bottleneck with the funds that the tour has, or the network, I guess. All right, let's move on to another thing, another kind of hot topic. This is one that's getting debated quite a bit. We talked about it on Grip Locked. Some people liked our take. Most people hated it. But the question is, and I'll update the points quickly here before we get into this. Brody has 5 right now, Hunter and Jonah at 6, and Steven at 5 as well. But the question is, did Kevin Jones lose the tournament by playing too conservative? I'll add to that, you know, down the stretch, I guess. Hunter and I on Grip Locked kind of argued that, at least in my mind, I was kind of arguing that I understood where he was coming from, and maybe I didn't. It's hard for us to know because we aren't there, but we typically favor the more aggressive play. People don't really like it when we say things like that. They just assume that we're just kind of talking crap to talk crap, but it is what it is. So I'd like to get all your opinions on it. Jonah, you can lead off for us.
Yeah, so I'm just going to preface my argument by saying there was a lot of conservative play out there this weekend, especially on the FPO side. For example, Ella Hansen definitely could have taken that tournament down. She laid up at least 5 putts in that final round from my count. And that is, you know, if you want to go out and win tournaments, you can't be laying up that many putts. That being said, though, for Kevin Jones, it's a little bit less straightforward. But I think down the stretch, like you were saying, Trevor, he didn't do enough to take down the event. So that's like a key difference between amateur and pro level of any sport is consistency while making the aggressive play. And Kevin had some closers on his back, Calvin Eagle, Paul Macbeth to a lesser extent, you know, down, breathing down his neck, making sure that he, you know, and Kevin, like, let them do what they wanted to do out there. I mean, that being said, Kevin stayed within his game. Maybe he didn't, going into the weekend, he didn't have the confidence to be like, okay, I'm going to, you know, on hole 17, he laid up for par on that hole and somehow made the putt from 30 feet away. I would have missed that putt and on any day of the week. I mean, yeah, but now he can go into his practice rounds and be like, okay, I have all the skills. I just need to practice those things, those aggressive plays more often. And I think that will pay off for him and hopefully sometime in the season.
It certainly seems like he had a game plan and stuck to it. Steven, what do you think about it?
First off, I want to say in the words of famous football movie coach Jimmy McGinty from The Replacements, winners always want the ball when the game is on the line. You have to have the killer instinct, the clutch gene, Mamba mentality, whatever you want to call it. Final round, KJ hit the triple Mando on four. I think it was due to him being a little bit timid with his shot, you know, with that lead. Day two, same course, he commits to that shot. He hits the birdie. Hole five, he misses low on the putt after watching Calvin Bird, you know, cash that bird. He lost three strokes in two holes to Calvin, and, you know, he was playing his game, but playing timid, he just wasn't getting in there. If it's not enough, Calvin's charging. Hole 14, day two, KJ birdies that hole. He got wind bullied on 18. I don't feel like he commit the same way he did in round two. He lost the tournament from playing safe. Even if he was playing his game, it just coming down that stretch, you gotta go for those shots.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always I can always get on board with the aggressive play. Brody has a little bit different perspective, I think. What do you have to say, Brody?
Well, okay, so let's talk some facts here. There was only three holes that played over par on Innova: 13, 16, and 18. There's only three holes that I would consider gettable birdies towards the back stretch on hole on Innova: 12, 14, 18, none of which Kevin birdied on the final round. He didn't lose because he wasn't playing aggressive. He lost because he didn't birdie the three really easy birdies coming in, 12, 14, 18. Also, if you want to like talk about aggressive or not aggressive, when Kevin was playing really aggressive and playing well in round two, he didn't throw into circle two on hole 15, 16, and 17. Hole 15, 16, and 17 are very difficult holes. So I don't know. Steven, you brought up hole 14. Did he lay up his tee shot on hole 14? So he threw a bad shot.
I think that was part of it, but I think it's because he was being timid.
Okay. I know Hunter wants to talk on this. I would love to hear it. I haven't watched. Quick plug, I am going to do a rewatch of the final round. So if anyone wants to tune into that, that will be live tonight. I will be doing a rewatch of it to see the actual shots. I haven't seen them yet, but I can only imagine Hunter coming in with the terrible take of him playing softer layups on holes that are really hard to birdie.
Well, let's hear what he has to say.
He lost because he didn't birdie 12, 14, 18. He birdies 12, 14, 18, he wins the tournament.
It's a good point, Hunter. What's your
All right, I'll use my 20 seconds that I have now allotted to me after Brody went 40 seconds over. No, look, there's no way to know what would happen if he didn't play conservatively, right? And to be clear, technically what lost him the event was trying
Where
to play aggressive.
Where did he play conservative?
Excuse me, sir. I'm on the clock. To be clear, he was in, I mean, hole 17, he clearly played conservative. Hole 16, he laid up a shot he could have went for. Hole 18, he technically lost the event by being aggressive. But here's what my opinion is. I think it's a lot harder to shift your mindset from a conservative mindset to an aggressive mindset than vice versa. Had he been aggressive down the stretch all day, then I personally think he might have been in a position on 18 where he could have shifted his mindset to conservative, which is way easier to do. He might have had a 2-3-stroke lead, because if you look down the stretch, he was basically on hole 17. He laid up with a putter, laid up to 30 feet, and he was basically saying, hey, Calvin, hit that 45-footer like you've been doing all day. How I view conservative play and what Kevin Jones did is he basically told Calvin, one of the best players in the world, consistent players in the world, here you go, bud. I'm giving you an opportunity to beat me. And shocker, Calvin did it.
Wait, I still don't understand how he played conservative on hole 17. Explain to me, because I haven't watched the coverage.
He went either putter or mid. He went either putter or mid off the tee.
He threw a 250-foot shot off the tee.
He threw a mid off the tee to the first little green patch on the fairway.
It didn't cost him, luckily.
Well, it could have.
Because he hit the putt. But it very easily could have, and I think the mindset is what cost him. It's back to the Chris Dickerson argument we used to have. He gave Calvin the momentum. And once you give up the momentum, it's impossible to get it back.
Go ahead, Brody.
So I'll just quickly say, so hole 17 plays about 525. It was probably playing into, I'm guessing if they had the same wind as we had, ahead left to right. With his style of throwing and the fact that there's trees on the right, OB left, his hyzer flip that he throws, that's a very difficult shot for him to even get close. Like I said before, I doubt that he had the layup play on round two. Didn't even get close to getting into circle two in round two. So my thought process is he is probably thinking I could go for this and lose the tournament, or I can make it, you know, make Calvin at this situation have to birdie. And then I'm trying to think, what was the scores there?
Calvin did not make his putt, but if Calvin had made his putt, he would have taken the lead. He would have put him away.
So they were tied, and though, Calvin at that point?
Calvin drove tied. First. They were tied because he went conservative on 16 and gave up a stroke to Calvin.
What did he throw on 16, a forehand?
It was the second shot.
The second shot, he decided not to get aggressive. So he gave up his
where
lead
was
there.
Where was his putt on the second shot?
What do you mean, where was his putt?
Like, you're saying he was
– Calvin was in circle two. On
16 is a par three. Hole 16 is a par three. Yes.
Are we a hole behind here? Which one?
Yes, hole 16 is a very – oh, no, you're talking about the 8-8-8 hole.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the new pin placement. Sorry.
Yeah.
Where was he in relation – how far away was his drive?
You're getting caught up on details. Do you want to win the tournament or do you want to lay up and lose?
Hunter, I threw as hard as I possibly could twice.
Lay up and lose then.
I would not have cleared the green. I was short left.
Well, Calvin did it. I mean, Calvin made the birdie.
Calvin throws really freaking far and really good in the wind because he keeps it low. I'm saying Kevin's throw, his hyzer flip throw into a headwind. I'm saying I don't see him not going for 16 as being conservative. I see him saying, if I go for this, I literally could lose the tournament.
That's the aggressive mindset is, you could lose, but it's on your own terms. Playing conservative, it's on someone else's terms if you win or lose. And I like it being
chances,
in my hand.
If your chances of birding a hole are
that's like Kobe Bryant having a somewhat contested shot and he kicking it over to Sean Marion in the corner.
Do you think he was conservative when he ran it on hole 18 and threw it OB and doubled?
Well, it was too late now. It was too late now. That's what I'm saying. Going from a conservative mindset, going conservative to aggressive when losing momentum, it's way harder to do that than vice versa. Being aggressive, keeping the momentum, that's what he could have done. It's laid up.
On hole 16, you do not need to throw the hero shot of where you're literally saying, if I make the execute the shot, which I have a 5% chance of doing, I might have a chance of winning, or I'm going to throw it OB.
16, we can go back and forth, whatever. 17, he saw Calvin's drive.
If I see 16 and I see that he's a 75 feet short of that 500 feet.
16, I'll give you. It could be a smart choice. 17, he can get there. Calvin was there. You have to in your mind, assume Calvin making that putt.
Did Calvin throw his black destroyer?
I don't know what Calvin threw. Shockingly, the Disc Golf Network didn't tell me.
I don't know. Yeah, anyways.
I'm guessing he threw his...
They were pretty good about that this weekend. Ian kept his mouth shut on the Disc.
I think this is what's happening, Brody, is I see your argument, and like probability agrees with Kevin Jones's play. However,
the problem is
what keeps happening is we keep seeing the conservative play lose, and it just... maybe it's recency bias, and maybe we're just not paying attention.
But why don't you guys talk about Portland Open? He should have been conservative in Portland Open when he 4 or 5 putted that one hole. No one ever brought that up.
My opinion.
Don't get out of that. Portland Open. Do you not remember hole 16 at Portland Open?
I don't.
Let me just tell you.
It was the basket on the little knoll. He had like a 35 footer. He could have easily laid up, tapped him for par, moved on. He tried to make it airballed. Had like another 35 footer. Try to make it airballed, and all of a sudden he went from leading the tournament to completely having no chance of winning.
My opinion, I would rather lose by being aggressive than lose and you're like, you're conservative and you have a question of like, what if I would have went for it on 17? What if I would have tried to get up and down on 16? I would rather be like, I tried everything I could and I messed up and that's why I lost.
If he would have birdied 18, we would be going in a playoff.
Yeah, that's what I said. Did you not hear a word I said? He was conservative. He tried shifting to be aggressive, and that's what lost him the turn on 18.
You don't shift to be aggressive on 18. Right. That's a birdie hole. He was playing the hole like he normally played.
He could have been in a position that he could have laid up, tap out par, and won. had he been aggressive on holes that are easier.
No, that's because Calvin birdied a hole that wasn't that he was. Calvin birdied two holes, 15 and 16, that are not birdie holes. If you remember, I said that KJ didn't even throw into circle two, round two, 15 and 16. 15 and 16 are incredible birdies. Calvin got both of them.
You got to be able to do it down the stretch. It doesn't matter what happened on the tournament
because he didn't birdie 14.
That's how he lost the tournament. There's got to be a way to deduct these guys' points.
I mean, I'm not going to give him any points. I wanted to get it all out of their system. So
and this thing, the fact that he still, I didn't even realize that he just needed a birdie 18. He goes to the playoff. This is crazy that you think he should be going for. I'm telling you, that shot, I guarantee I'm going to watch it. I'm going to be like, Hunter, it's the same shot. He has to throw a 550-foot shot into a headwind.
But Calvin was in this position. You have to guarantee. You have I'm saying
550 because of the headwind.
The only reason KJ was in the position that he had to birdie 18 was because Calvin missed the putt that you have to assume on the tee Calvin was going to make.
That's what's
Calvin 45 feet short on 17, by the way.
Mm-hmm. It was like right. He was almost pin high right. What?
Was he short or pin high right? Those are two way different things.
It was not like 45 short. It was right. So he was a little short, a little right.
So probably 25 feet short, I guess.
Okay, so Calvin threw like as hard as he could, 480.
All I'll
feet.
Say is I was just surprised to see Calvin with a putt to basically put it away, and Kevin Jones still lay up. But I mean, I don't know, man. I'm ducking out of this argument because if I was Kevin Jones,
what did he say after the round? Didn't he get interviewed?
Yeah, I mean,
ask him that?
I mean, he had a game plan and he stuck to it and he didn't execute. Like, I mean, it's one of those. Why didn't you run the ball? You got Marshawn Lynch situations where if you make it happen, nobody says anything, right? Like, if Kevin Jones plays it well, I think that. Anytime a player makes a very clear game plan decision and then it goes awry, there's going to be pushback and it's going to happen both ways. It is what it is. Let's move on. This is something that was another kind of hot topic in Vegas. We'll get a little points update. Brody's at 7 right now. Jonah and Steven at 8. Hunter in the lead at 9. This is our last topic here before the rapid fire round. Many players, you know, we had some interesting conditions in Vegas. As is typical with the beginning of the year event, we get quite an interesting draw. Many players were complaining about the vast difference in conditions, especially concerning wind from the early tee times to the late tee times. Is this a real problem? And if so, what is a good solution, Steven?
So I'm actually really curious to see what Brody has to say about this because I know he knows a little bit more about the PGA and how they handle this situation. I think until the tour moves to 4-round tournaments for every event, it'll continue to be a problem. I think that a 4-round tournament, you cut the field in half. You have the first half play in the morning, second half play in the afternoon, round two they switch, and then in my opinion, you should have a cut after 2 rounds, and then you play rounds 3 and 4 with the leaders having the scheduled tee times. That being said, I mean, weather is a part of disc golf. You kind of have to play your game regardless of the situation that you're put in. If you're on 18 and then all of a sudden you're the last person to putt and a giant like gust of wind comes, like you still have to make your putt. I mean, that's what it is. Ground play, tree kicks, gust of wind, they all happen during a round. You as a player have to adapt to your situation, be able to play your game regardless of what's going on around you. At this point, I don't know if it's really a huge problem. We still feature our best players every first round of the tournament, so they're going to get the valued tee times that everybody wants because the Pro Tour wants them on coverage. It's just something that the tour right now has to just deal with. But I think if they move to 4-round tournament, it'll help the situation a bit.
Yeah, all right, Brody. What do you think?
Well, I think right now we're under the – like. The way we're doing things is because of the media, right? We're kind of handcuffed in that way. If they want to be able to do live FPO and live MPO, the FPO needs to be at the end. And then for them to have enough time to, you know, charge batteries, dump footage, whatever it is before the MPO go off, they need to be the last ones. If that was an issue, if we could kind of do whatever we wanted, I would agree with Steven. I think to make it the fairest possible is you play with the same group the first 2 days and you flip flop. So if you went off in the morning, you go off in the afternoon in round two and vice versa. And then when it comes to feature cards, because I know there have been pros that have pushed back at, you know, well, these guys are always on feature cards, so they always get those late time slots. The only way of combating that, because I do not think that we should just be allowing anyone on feature cards. I think the people that push, you know, the viewers the most should always be on those feature cards. But the only way of combating that is, again, having the freedom of being able to film a 1:15 tee time, even though maybe the last tee time is at 3. So that feature card is just going off at 1:15 because that's where the time slot was. That's the only thing. There's just going to be some tournaments where you just get a bad draw, and there's going to be some tournaments where you get a good draw, and hopefully it just kind of levels itself out throughout the season. And I think the best way of getting to that point is having the alternate tee times for the first 2 days.
Yeah. Went a man down there. Hopefully Jonah jumps back in. I agree. It's a complex issue. Hunter, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is a real problem, but similar to what Brody was saying, it's not really solvable with our current coverage format, not necessarily the whole battery swap and stuff like that, but because of the way we consume disc golf, we're not seeing all day coverage shots from all over the place. If you take the leader, if you have the Steven solution where you flip flop, which I think would be a possible solution, the leader could be anywhere in the field. And if we're only having coverage in a certain window, there's a solid chance that that leader is already done before coverage starts. Now, personally, I don't think it's a serious enough problem that needs to be fixed, mainly because as the season goes on, it kind of all balances out. You know, right now we're hearing about there was a lot of wind in the morning, and people are complaining because the afternoon tee times didn't have to deal with wind. As the tour makes its way East Coast, guess what happens? That flip-flops. Those morning tee times are going to be wind-free, and then the afternoon tee times are going to be dealing with wind. Across the course of a season, I would say weather probably affects players pretty evenly because you tend to have similar players teeing off late, similar players teeing off early. That's kind of the way it is. So I think that you just hear about it when it's an event like this where it's a drastic difference morning to afternoon or vice versa. Players cause a stink, but I don't think it's a big enough thing that we really need to like be stressing over it and trying to figure it out, because also like it's only going to affect really one day. And if we have 4 day tournaments, which is what the Pro Tour is headed towards, it also is going to balance itself out across days 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah. All right, Jonah, what are your thoughts on the wind situation?
Yeah, I got a little bit of a room to make up, but I'll try my best here. It's not a problem. It's a part of our sport. If the players want to, you know, make those lead cards in the second, third, and fourth rounds, they got to get better. I mean, that's just part of the game. It's the learning curve of getting on tour. That's like a skill that, you know, if a player wants to break through, want to have a breakthrough event, then they need to learn how to play in those conditions, whether that is playing maybe more conservative and not trying to push the envelope a little bit too much and improve their round rating. And, you know, that's something that, you know, skilled professionals will learn how to do eventually. And I think at least in the MPO division, that's getting better. We can see that with like the parity. I think like even like down to like T20, if it was only like a 5-stroke difference. That being said though, like the only control having courses on tour that don't become more difficult with different winds is to have more wooded courses. And that goes directly against what the Pro Tour wants to do with the spectators that they're trying to get out there. Again, like having these more heavily wooded courses mitigate the wind more. And, but then again, as less spectators are allowed to be at the events. I mean, that's why I think that the top events should be at more wooded courses. They have more skill involved and take the other factors out of the game, like wind. Yeah, I mean, that's why I think, you know, Champions Cup at WR Jackson's a great play. And, you know, at the bottom line, it's not a problem. It's just an excuse for those second tier pros to really have to, you know, make a push.
I think it's a complex issue. And I think that, like, here's a scenario nobody really mentioned is you can do with disc golf, because we play at two courses sometimes at event, you could even do the flip-flop. Let's say we have our scenario where we get that flip-flop. Well, what happens when the first round is at a wide open course where the wind is going to matter a heck of a lot more and the next one's in the woods? So now all of a sudden that flip-flop
should never happen. You can't.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, so even
our fields aren't big enough for you to like be doing that.
I'm just saying, well, there are events that like because of the flip-flop, like that could be the case. Like, let's say you're playing Ledgestone.
We shouldn't have 250 people in the field at Ledgestone.
Well, I'm saying like day to day, the flip flop.
Washington had 250 people.
Let's say it's windy mornings, Brody. Let's say it's Vegas. Let's say we're at Vegas and one of the courses you were playing was in the wind. The wind is in the morning both days. Well, the first group, they have to play in the wind, but they're at the open course.
They're in the open. I see what you're saying.
So, like, because of the complexity of how disc golf, like that dual course thing, I don't know if this issue is ever really going to be perfectly solved. I think that there's a lot of frustrated pros, and Jonah kind of alluded to, like, there is always the, like, you know, just get better. And Hunter kind of always also alluded to, like, this kind of balances itself out, because that is kind of true as well. But I think a lot of pros get frustrated and go to social media with this, and it is at the end of the day, like, everybody gets bad breaks. You know, I think there are some guys out there that don't think other people get bad breaks, and everybody gets bad breaks. And sure, there's always going to be some part of sports, especially golf, that doesn't feel fair. But I think there's only so much you can do with the win scenario. With that being said, we're going to move on. We have Hunter and Steven with 11 points each emerging into the today's elimination round. So we're going to go to the rapid fire round now, presented by Foundation Care. All right. Today's rapid fire round is brought to you by Foundation Care. If you've ever shopped at foundationdisc.com recently, you might notice that we have a little add-on now called Foundation Care. This is a program we've started in the past few months where you are able to buy a disc, add Foundation Care to that product, and then have the option to return it after using it. You go out, throw it in the field, test it out, take it on the course with you, and as long as you know it's not completely beat to death, it just has normal wear and tear, you can trade that thing right back in and try another new disc, and then we will be able to repurpose that disc in our certified use section. So this is a great opportunity to try a new mold that you've always wanted to try, but you're not sure if you want to spend the money. So make sure to go to foundationdisc.com, add on that Foundation Care to your product, and it gives you a great option to try out some new plastic. So make sure to check that out, foundationdisc.com. Let's get into this rapid fire round. We've got a tie ball game. I don't even know if we've had a tie yet going into the rapid fire round. It's very exciting. We've got Hunter and Steven all knotted up at 11 points each, with three topics here in the rapid fire round. So we don't have a leader currently, which is usually how I select who goes first. So the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to pick a number between 1 and 10, and then I'm going to let you each guess. So Hunter, what's your guess?
6.
Steven?
3.
My number was 6.
We're in sync.
That is not fair. That's shenanigans.
Would you like to go first or second, Hunter?
Let me go first.
Okay, Hunter wants to lead off. First topic today. FPO coverage was something this weekend. It was a little bit of a bumble stumble to the finish. There was a lot of players who had a chance to get back into it and couldn't put anything together. Paige and Kristen weren't there. You know, that's certainly a big part of the FPO field. They don't have the same kind of parity that the men's field have, so missing them is certainly a big deal. So my question here is the FPO field hopeless without Paige and Kristen, or was this event just some of the rust being shaken off? Hunter?
First off, how dare you leave Balmain Tejano off that list? But it depends on what you mean by hopeless. Is golf going to be worse with them gone? Duh. I mean, they're two of the best FPO talents of all time. So without them in the field, yeah, things are going to look a little bit worse. The things at the top probably are going to be a little bit different. But I mean, I wouldn't call it hopeless. It gives other players a chance to shine, a chance to, you know, make their name known, and had a few shots, gone a few different ways, had Missy and Ella capitalized on some of the, you know, putts and throws that they choked on, we might be having a completely different conversation here. So I don't think it's hopeless. I think that Vegas is just kind of a weird event. It was a shame they weren't out there. But it was not pretty at times. I will give you that.
All right, Steven.
I'm going to say, again, I agree with Hunter, not hopeless, but I will say it's a little bleak until the Pro Tour starts putting some real work into these FPO layouts. Obviously, this course is going to, you know, favor Kat. She's one of the furthest throwing women on the course, especially when you don't have a Paige or a Kristen out there to kind of offset that, or Val, as eloquently put there by Hunter. But I think that until they really put some work into those FPO layouts, you're going to have those main four or five women that are kind of always at the top with a few others scattered in. I think Hall and Hanley is going to break out this season, as long as she can nail down that consistency along with Ella Hansen. But I do think first event of the season without Kristen or Paige or Val, it was kind of Kat's show to lose, and you know, she tried to a couple of times, but she came out victorious.
Yeah, I think it's just very noticeable when those top players are missing. You don't have the same parity because we only have so many of that top group. And it's a good point, Stephen, with the course design. That's something we've talked about a lot that needs to progress. But it's so difficult right now. Like, what do you really cater to? We've talked about that before as well, because some of those par threes and fours that are just those random distances that just the farther throwers have a huge advantage. All right. Next topic, the DGPT recently came out and changed the tour championship format, met with some backlash. Some people love it. It's certainly a lot different. They're very much stepping away from what they were doing with the bracket and moving towards more of the PGA Tour model. So my question just is simply, is this new tour championship format good? Why or why not? Steven, start it off for us.
Is it good? I'm not sure if it's quite there yet as far as being like the perfect solution. I think it's a huge step in the right direction. Having an actual two-round final where it is stroke play and you're going to get to see them duke it out for an entire two rounds, I think it's going to make it a lot more exciting, especially when it comes down to the finish. It's going to feel more like a tour championship tournament as opposed to the tour championship that Hunter would like, the first place winner to actually win the event. I think that there needs to be a little more to it than that. In this scenario, I think that they did the right thing. Giving the stroke advantage gives the players a lot more to play for coming down the stretch, especially in those playoffs that, you know, those top eight guys, they should be jockeying a little bit more for position. You want that first place. You want that extra stroke to make sure that you get yourself into the finals. And I think it does remove a lot of the parity that we've seen from the bracket style event that we've witnessed over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Hunter, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key is in the question that you asked, right? Is it the Pro Tour Championship? The previous format was a lot of fun, right? It was a great time. It created some very exciting disc golf, but it wasn't the Tour Championship. I think that's something that they could bring back in a different format. People really enjoyed it. But for the Tour Championship, you want to reward people who have had the best seasons. You want to give them a solid chance to be in contention down the stretch. And I think actually the biggest point of why this was a good change is actually what you had said yesterday on Grip Lock, Trevor, which is it's a lot easier to follow where it puts everyone together in the same pool. So when everyone's playing together, you don't have this weird thing of like, oh, James Conrad beat X, Y, and Z players, but he's not going to make the advancement because of the card he was on. When everyone's in the same pool, it's a lot easier to follow. It's a lot easier to get the point across. And I think it's going to be more exciting personally.
Yeah, I think organized chaos is kind of how the last event was, and it provided some very good entertainment. But figuring things out was incredibly difficult. All right, still tied up at 16, headed on to our final topic. It's going to be a winner take all here. The DGPT has yet again changed the criteria for player of the year votes. It is now 50-50 between media members and Pro Tour card holders. Is this the best way to decide the player of the year? Back to Hunter.
I mean, is there actually a best way to decide this award? I think that no matter what happens, this award will always be one of the most talked about, one of the most controversial, because at the end of the day, the player that wins the award most seasons, there's going to be a few other players that have a strong argument for and against them as well. And so what you're going to end up with is fans and media having a lot to talk about, a lot to argue over. I think going in this direction, I think it's a sidestep from what they were doing last year. Personally, I think the best way to do it would have a committee. That committee has an objective way that they decide this based on stats, based on the storylines. It's not just the eye test. That way you remove any chance of late season bias, which is still going to be a risk with this new 50-50 vote process.
Yeah, okay. Steven, what do you think about the new process?
I think it's better than what they were. Well, I don't know if it's better than what they were doing before. I think the sidestep is the right word for it. I don't know if it's the best way. I honestly, personally think that you play a full season and you hand out points for being the best at the tournaments. The player with the most points at the end of the year is in first place for the tour. They should be considered the player of the year. You did the best at all the tournaments. You got the most points. You're the player of the year. You beat out everybody else. And I think that deviating any way from that, it makes it more opinionated than fact-based.
Okay. I think you're almost there. I like that train of thought, and I agree that like last year's system, I liked that they were heavily weighing the tour points and your average finishing place at Elite Series and Major. But I do think that if you go completely that route, you do. There is that chance that you have a player that earned more points because they just dominated Silver Series and whatnot. You know, Hunter's gonna, you know, pass out. You could have a player
that's not gonna win you the tour. That's not gonna win you first place.
Well, you could have a player who wins two majors. Let's just say, like, you can have a resume where somebody has majors in their resume and somebody doesn't, but somebody still edged them out in points and the wins. I think if you go straight up, there could be arguments made.
Well, I think what you described right there is similar to how the PDGA has been doing Player of the Year,
right?
And we've seen them screw Paige multiple times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
the FPO field.
I think it's a balance, and I like the players getting a vote considered, because, you know, but it's like. It's just hard to, and I think Hunter hit it on the head, and I think this is like the ultimate just truth about Player of the Year is that it will always be debated because there will always be some kind of subjective situation with it. So that's what it comes down to. So I think I'll give Hunter the edge on that one. I'm gonna have to give it to him this time. So Hunter with the win, 19-18. Steven, good battle. Everybody, good battle today. Hunter, what would you like to say to everybody?
I would just like to attribute this win to my aggressive play out here. Brody, maybe if you were a bit more aggressive, you could make it to more of these rapid fire rounds and maybe you'll be able to get a win one day. But with your conservative play, you know, I'm sorry I had to leave you in the dust.
Wow.
I'll be the first to say if I'm going to watch the footage tonight. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But
I'm going to say I don't think your opinion is going to change, and that is all I'll say about that. Well, everybody, that's been another episode of Debate Night. This is you're going to see a lot more topical things going on as we move throughout the season. I think it's going to provide a lot of awesome topics because, you know, we weren't just here to talk about, you know, this show is not really a tournament recap as much as let's find the storylines that happened in the tournament, break them down, see if there's any further implications. Great show from all of our panelists today. If you decide that you want to be a panelist on this show sometime and you think you have some interest in that, make sure to reach out to us. We'd love to have you audition. Jonah had his first show today. That's how he got on, and he did a great job. So shout out to Jonah. That's it for our first in the season episode of Debate Night. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week.